Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice. I am Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass and you are listening to Tuesday's show, The Engagement Hours. The Morning Voice, 5 days a week, five different hosts, five different approaches to talking about things that are going on in our community. We greatly appreciate you joining us today. And again, Tuesdays, we really focus on civic engagement because we are a nation bound by shared values of freedom, liberty, and equality. And with that comes some rights and responsibilities. For some, that includes service to our country, and to others, service in or for our community. Bottom line is we try to expose you to people who are involved in our region, talk some of the politics of our region, and get you to want to get engaged and try to make a difference. Speaking of making a difference, Matt, I want to thank you and Charles last week for coming out to the 9/11 Towers Challenge on Thursday.
That was really special, Ted. It was great to see you there. Certainly not a surprise by any means. And I'll tell you what, first time I've actually been to that event, and I've known about it, it was really special to actually attend it and see with my own two eyes the firefighters in full gear, the community members that just want to go out and remember people who ran towards danger, and to see the dramatic display. It's dramatic because of what it is, but to see the display of all the first responders, the pictures of them, lining the concourse, lining the route up the stairs, so you could see, and every person could be seen and remembered. And of course, it just kind of grabs you. Like at the bottom, there was a picture, the person's name, maybe what their specific job was, firefighter, what their rank within the fire department was, or law enforcement, or military, and then end of watch.
Yeah, it really is. And they've added a lot of things over the time. In 2011, when they first did it as part of the 10th year anniversary, it was actually done at 5151. They actually climbed the stairs 51, and it was first responders only. The next year, they advanced it. They actually went out and did it at Arizona Stadium, where they held it for a long time. But the next year was really only first responders and members of the military. And slowly they've advanced it. They've brought the community into it. They've given people an opportunity. They've really made it so that the purpose of the 9/11 Tower Challenge Foundation is to never forget what happened on that day. Both never forget who it was that brought us upon us, and the fact that we came together as a country. Ben Bueller Garcia said something in his opening that I always appreciate. And that is, it's not just about remembering 9/11. It's about remembering 9/12, the day after. And that really is when our country came together. Some of the greatest stories I remember, people who were out in the woods hiking, and they came into little towns in remote parts of Colorado 3 days after the event to find the streets lined in flags. And they had no idea what happened. So I think sometimes we forget how strong of a country could be, and the 9/11 Tower Challenge never wants us to forget.
And I'm going to put this up. You were walking for somebody special.
I was, and
everybody was special, but there you were walking. About the person you were.
One of the things they do, everybody who walks is given a badge. And it's a badge with a firefighter or a first responder or anyone who perished that day. And it really is a reminder. I tell Katie and I have done several of these together. The one that got our attention probably the most was during COVID, when we couldn't do it in a big activity, so you had to do it remote. We found a set of, I think it was about 25 stairs on one of the hikes that we routinely would do.
Yep.
And that day, them sending us the badges and us having to firefighters that we were walking for, mm-hmm. or walking in remembrance of, really made a difference. And we did those stairs time and time again until we hit that magic number of 2,071 steps, which is the two. This year, I had my firefighter on the badge was Gary Box with Squad Company 1, age 37. And if you're on Facebook or YouTube, you might be able to see his picture. And I think Matt's got
1030 The Voice on YouTube is where we're at. Is where we're at today, and you can see a picture. And I'll even let me. I've got a bigger version of the picture, a close up of the picture, right.
And after doing this, I decided to look a little bit more into
to
firefighter box and squad company one. And it was pretty amazing because the picture that you might see right now, if you're watching us on YouTube, is a picture of Gary Box running through the tunnel to get there.
Yeah.
His trucks had become blocked because of a blown tire, and several of their members continued to run towards the towers to help everyone else. There's a great article if you look it up online about his father who hadn't talked to him that day, which he quite often did. And they did not know what that happened to his son. And it was finding that picture years later. It was a picture taken by a Danish businessman that led him one last glimpse of his son. And the 9/11 memorial, National Museum Memorial, brought together the photographer and the dad.
Oh.
And it was just an incredibly emotional experience for him. Firefighter Box was a member of Squad Company 1, and on September 11th, Squad 1 crossed the Brooklyn Bridge to respond to the attacks, and 12 members died when the towers collapsed. They were last seen in the South Tower of the World Trade Center. Their pumper engine was recovered and is now on display at the Smithsonian. So I really wanted to appreciate KVOI, Bustos Media, for letting you go out there and do that. I think the 9/11 Tower Challenge, Ben Bueller Garcia has been an integral part. There's numerous fire members of both the police and firefighter associations that have been putting this thing together. And it's just an incredible event. And I really appreciate the station supporting it, and was glad to see you and Charles there.
And I've got it on close up for you and me on our screen, but I'll tell you what, and just, they've got the fire bells in the middle of the arena where when people finish the climb, they go ring that bell, and just hearing that bell clang and clang and clang 1100 times for all these participants, really amazing. And all these heroic souls, hopefully rest easy knowing that they did a good thing in this world and that people remember them, 24 years later, and will continue to remember them 24 years from now and 100 years from now for what they did. Really special. Heard a few stories over the course of the day. Also, I saw everything from mothers carrying infants on the climb to a World War II veteran making the rounds on the concourse. Don, met him, and I just happened to be down there because I wanted to see what it was like as they came by and rang the bell. And I just happened to be there when he was there. I looked up and I said, my gosh, that's Don. I just met him a little bit ago.
He had a hard time making it all the way around. He was in a wheelchair. He had somebody that was helping him do it. But the reason he had a hard time is everybody wanted to shake his hand.
Right, right.
And I remember distinctly coming up on my last.
I was one of them.
my last lap.
I did twice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember coming up on my last lap and seeing him sitting there, and I went over and thanked him. And the joy on his face.
Yeah.
And the appreciation, and there was four people in line behind me by the time I continued the thing. And there's so many things about it that even as a military service member, and I did the first few years in uniform in my flight suit.
Yeah.
Big deal. Watching the firefighters and the police, members of the police force who are doing it in their full gear. I mean, several of the firefighters were on their breathing devices, which are very difficult to breathe through. And some of them would do it for one, some would two, some would do all three laps that we made around the arena that day, going up and down the stairs. And I mean, the weight and the heavy, and you can't even envision what it would have been like if they were actually doing that during that day with the buildings on fire, not knowing what they were going into, not knowing what they were going to find. And it just tells you what service to the community and country can be.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank the station for letting me go do that. I want to thank Ben and the committee there for just an amazing job and service they do. And I'd also like to thank Tom for yielding a few minutes of the show to us so we could kind of help tell the story to the Morning Voice listeners. And so the Morning Voice listeners who didn't register and who couldn't be a part of it for whatever reason were able to kind of experience it. So it was really cool.
Absolutely. And the thing that they've added to the experience over the last several years now is every year, series of men and women swear in to the military. And this year there was five men and women that were joining the 162nd wing, which is the wing I served in when I was here in Tucson, swore in to join. And the amazing part about it is most of these folks weren't even born on 9/11.
That's right.
And for all the criticism sometimes we give the next generations, you know, it's always, they're not what we were, they aren't. One thing that this generation has never done, had a problem doing since 2001, really, is putting their hand in the air and being willing to serve. And that shows you something about our country. And it shows you something about the desire to not only give back, but also to protect the rights and responsibilities that we have in this country. So appreciate, Matt, you having that conversation with me this morning.
And tell the folks our hero's name did it once more before we move on.
That was Gary Box, Squad 1.
Gary Box,
Squad 1. New York Fire Department.
Yeah, I recognize the walls of that tunnel. A lot of us have driven through those, and nothing was going to hold him up from doing his job.
They weren't. They were all intent on getting
tire, traffic,
and making a difference.
I'm going. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And him and his battalion mates.
Absolutely. So I know it was a little less than a week ago, but it's something that we should think about all the time. And I appreciate you all joining us this morning. We've got a great show. When we return after the break, we will have Chancellor Jeff Nassy with us from Pima Community College.
All the music they played during the event, this one hit me the hardest. So this is for you, Gary.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely behind the glass, keeping me on time and on target. And we are now joined by Dr. Jeffrey Nassy. So it's great to see you.
Good morning, Ted. Great to be back. Good morning, Matt. Good to see everyone. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, absolutely. Can't say enough about what PCC does. The hardest part, as I was prepping for this interview, was it's been a year.
Yes,
it's actually already been a full year.
Yes, so I've made it a year. So yeah. That's good.
Well,
yeah, thank you.
You've made it a year. How did you find the reception here in Tucson?
It's been a wonderful first year. My wife and I love it. It's a great community, great college, lots of opportunity, and so we're thrilled to be here. And you know, before we begin, thank you, Ted. You're one of the first people that welcomed me when I first arrived here in Tucson, and I see you everywhere in the community, the work you're doing for Southern Arizona Leadership Council and beyond, and your support for Pima Community College has been outstanding, of course, your service. So thank you for all of that.
Well,
much appreciated.
I greatly appreciate that as well. Yeah, I remember that first meeting, a lot to talk about, and I think it was the second meeting. You said, okay, now you got to tell me all the stuff you didn't tell me the first time.
Right.
And figure out what's really going. What's your biggest surprise been before we get into some of the your goals for the next year? What was your biggest surprise?
Well, I think
a year later,
the community investment in Pima is just really outstanding. You know, I've been in the community college space for all of my career, and certainly people love their community college. But in Pima, that's next level, right? In Tucson, everywhere I go, people really care about the institution at a level that is remarkable. And so that's great. It's a positive surprise for sure.
So I was looking online and saw that you had your three goals from when you first got here,
sure,
which was all about, mostly about transition and getting comfortable and going. Now that you go into year number two, you've been able to set a new set of goals for 25, right, 26, and adapt and advance together, yeah, for the students. You want to talk about those,
sure,
a little bit?
You know, the first year for me was all about listening and learning, right? It was a new state, new city, and really wanted to understand a lot of things about the college. And yeah, to your point, this year's theme is all about adapting, right? So advancing where we can. Adapting isn't just changing everything, right? It's building on successes and adapting. And importantly, right, it's adapt, advance, go forward, get better always. And it's together for students, right? And so really playing up that idea of unity at the college in support of student outcomes.
Now, your first goal in there is directly related to student outcomes, both improving the touch of Pima Community College by growing enrollment, which I believe it was just announced for this 10th straight year Pima Community College's enrollment has grown, but you've set some bigger and loftier goals. And the second half of your first goal was the one that caught my attention. That is improving student persistence.
Sure. Yeah, so it's 10 semesters. I wish it was 10 years, but 10 semesters of continued growth, yeah.
I'm just counting right. That we're going to get to 10 years.
Right. Yeah, no, thank
10
you.
10 semesters is good,
I appreciate
too.
That. Yeah, we've had, you know, it's been remarkable, you know, since going on the ground. That is the lifeblood of the college, right? The enrollment is so key, is that promise of college education. We know it makes such a difference in the lives of our students. So how do we get more people into the college? You know, our slogan, if you will, that what we're talking about is, you know, make someday today, right? We have all these people who said, oh, I've always thought about getting a certificate or welding, or I always wanted that nursing degree, or I'm interested in business. And so, you know, that first goal is all about how do we make sure that our students in this community have access to high quality post-secondary education at Pima Community College. And you're right, the part B is, and then how do we make sure that they finish what they've started, right? That they complete those certificates and degrees. So what can we do? And that can, people may not finish for a variety of reasons. So how can we provide flexibility, support, options for students to make sure they stay and finish those degrees, those certificates, whatever it is that they may be pursuing at Pima, that can make such a tremendous difference in their lives. So you're right, enrollment persistence is kind of a fundamental, that's the number one goal. It's consistent from last year that we'll continue to focus on.
And roughly PCC's over 17,000 students now. It looks like, I think your goal is to get it up closer to 18,500
by next year. 17,000 this fall, it's 7% up from last year. Over the course of a year, we serve about 35,000 students. And you have fall, spring, summer, everything.
And that's a really incredible number when you think about it. And a lot of the shift, you talked about the persistence staying to it. More and more students appear to be going down the career track through the college.
Sure.
But, you know, it used to always be, you'd go to the college, it was setting up either for the 4-year degree, or you'd go get training elsewhere. But now at PCC, you're really an economic driver in a lot of way by creating that workforce.
Oh, absolutely. Workforce development is the heart of the education. No matter what you want to do, you know, we still have, right, a lot of students that want to transfer over to the University of Arizona. Absolutely. We're working closely with their new administration. We support that. But our programs, building construction technology, Ted, right? Last year we had a 2,000 square foot facility. This year we'll open up a 22,000 square foot facility. Those programs are growing in leaps and bounds. We have a new welding facility, and we can't put our welders out fast enough. Cybersecurity is a 2-year degree program out at our East Campus, is growing in leaps and bounds. So I think always we're orienting, right? We're always talking to students, no matter what that is, even if it is the 4-year degree. Hey, this is about career, right? This is about jobs. This is about economic mobility. And then working a lot with our industry partners. How are we being responsive? We know from the employers that we talk to across, I don't care if it's healthcare and nursing, first responders, whatever it is, artificial intelligence. So that's something we'd like to see across our curriculum, right? Because we know our employers want to see that from our graduates.
Well, there's no doubt the economic development side of it is a big piece for the college and for the community. We continue to struggle a little bit with some of our poverty levels and some of our unemployment numbers.
Sure.
So what you're doing is absolutely incredible. One of the other things that caught my attention was your third goal, and that has to do with having an emergency.
Yeah, emergency preparedness.
And as troubling it is to have to talk about this so much,
sure,
it obviously is a reality that I think if you're not prepared, you're going to be in the world of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, coming out of last year, people would say, you know, what keeps you up at night? And as someone who, we have 5 campuses, they're open campuses. You know, back in Florida, I was a dean in the county where Marjorie Stoneman Douglas occurred. So I know well, I was the dean of education at that time. You know, unfortunately, campus violence, and it's not always that, right? There can be chemical spills, there can be fires, right? And so I've really elevated that idea of emergency preparedness. at the institution. We're going to really focus on, and listen, you know, we can have the greatest plans in the world, and we all know this. This, the reality is you can't prepare for anything. But are we doing everything we can to keep our students, our faculty, our staff, our community that we serve as safe as possible? So you're right, I've elevated that as a primary goal this year to just continue to work through. And that will always be the case.
And for those who get concerned about the funding, how it works, how's the college is doing, there are two of your goals, and I don't want to go into deep on them because I would definitely want to hit goal number four. But I just want the listeners to know you're identifying a goal of reducing your ongoing expenditures by $4 million per year.
Sure. You know, so along with, you know, number one always is safety, right? And the well-being of our students. The second thing, Ted, I think about a lot is, are we being the very best steward of our resources, right? Two primary streams of revenue for Pima Community College, that is tuition, and we really want to keep that low. We really believe in the value proposition for our families in community college education, and property taxes. And I'm proud to say last year, in my first year, we did not raise either. We did not raise tuition nor property taxes at the college. And so looking at it, I know we've set a goal of, can we reduce our recurring expenses by $4 million? I think we can. It will be challenging, and it's our responsibility to do so. We need to be as efficient, as lean as possible in order to maximize those opportunities for our community and the students. So not always the sexiest goal, right? Reducing spending, but so important, right? Is gaining efficiencies. Where can we find duplication? How can we leverage technology in different ways, right? It's 2025. This is not the college that I attended. Or even my kids attended, you know, so
they're not writing in Fortran anymore.
Right.
Well, that's the voice of Chancellor Jeff Finessi. He's at Pima Community College. When we come back, I do want to go back and talk about your first year experience program.
Sure.
But I guarantee our listeners appreciate you saving the dollars as well.
We're doing our best.
So stay with us. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back.
Go to YouTube, 1030 The Voice, if you'd like to watch as well as listen.
Good morning. September 16th, just past the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour. Appreciate you joining us if you're either in the car or you're at home or you're watching us online. The Morning Voice, every morning, 7 and 9 on 1030 KVOI. We appreciate you joining us. So Dr. Jeff Nassie's with me this morning. We've been talking.
Morning.
Good morning. It's always good to have you here. Yeah. We've been talking your chancellor's goals. Goal number four to me is one I do want you to talk a little bit about. You've talked about persistence. You talked about the fact that numbers are going up. But there's a new program you're looking at launching, and it's called the First Year Experience. Can you just talk a little bit about that program?
Yeah. So coming out of last year, right, listening to the community, listening to our students, our faculty and staff, we know that kind of that entryway. So that's everything, Ted, from the application, right, just applying Pima Community College can be, you know, I've heard it was difficult, it was a challenge. So we're launching a new application all the way through registration, student orientation. You know, we serve, of course, a lot of first-generation students at the college. Those are students who family members have never gone to the college. They're the first in their families to go to college. And so really orienting on all of those things, financial aid, how to register for classes, where do I get support, where is tutoring, you know, all of those things as you come into the college, we really want to maximize that experience, right? We want it to be dynamic. We want it to be, here's a big word in education, fun, right? We want fun for our students. Obviously, you know, we're a community college. We're a community college. People aren't living on campus, but when they are on campus, do they have great Wi-Fi? Do they have something to eat? Are they having fun? How are they engaged? That's all part of student success. And so this goal, this team is really working on that whole first year for our students. We think is critical. It leads to everything else, right? Success in the classroom, those career pathways that we've talked about. That's that foothold for those students that we think is so critical. So we're spending a considerable amount of time. You know, we saw in when we're looking at our own data, we have a student success course, and we saw that students who take this class and are successful in it persist and graduate at much better rates than those who don't. So how do we scale that to make sure that they're all getting that experience? So that's what the first year experience is all about.
Or your goals are bold. You know, it's a 25 to 26. I guess it could go on beyond that. But
yeah, chances goals are 1 year.
Yeah, and you've got deadlines that you put in there for what you expect to have happen. But you seem to address everything. We've talked about the students, their performance, their persistence, making it better for their environment, making sure the college is safe. And you've also addressed some of the financials in there. You know, you've talked about the savings piece of it. But overall, how has the college been impacted by either the federal cuts, lack of state funding, and other things? How's that
tied
into your goals?
Yeah, so along with tuition, of course, and property taxes, we have some level of kind of one-offs in state funding that we've been able to get. And by the way, bipartisan support for Pima Community College at both the federal and state level, and just a shout out to all of our representatives on both sides of the aisle. To me, this is a nonpartisan win, right? This is all about investment in our community, and they've been supportive. But yes, we have lots of federal grants. In particular, we have 10 what they call TRIO grants. These are long-standing grants. I think they go back to the 90s, you know, where this is all about, these are federal funds used to bring more people into college in our TRIO grants. We actually had 10 of them, 10 individual grants that make up those TRIO grants, and we've lost 5 of them. The federal government has discontinued those grants. And some of this is not just about Pima students, right? This is about local high school students. Sunnyside School District, for example, we have a couple of TRIO grants there that have been discontinued from the federal government. And so, you know, we try to understand what's going on and happening in those discontinuations. And you know, that's fine. Okay, we will adapt. We will work with those school districts. We'll see what we can do to mitigate the impact on students as best we can. But right, there's a reason they're grants, right? Those grants were funding some of those programs. So yeah, 5 out of the 10, and we also are of course right here in Tucson are proudly a Hispanic-serving institution, and have been historically, and the government is also looking into cutting some of that what we call HSI funding. So we're looking at about $4 million in grant fundings just this year that is likely to go away from the federal government. So some challenges there.
And that doesn't count the $4 million you're going to try to reduce in your current expenses.
Correct.
Either. I mean, I guess that you could say it's kind of a balance, but the focus still is on what the community
savings.
College provides to the community, and that's graduates, that's employees, that's good citizens to step in and make our community prosper.
Of course, yeah, that's the mission of our college. And again, right, it's all about career pathways.
Right.
For instance, as you know, Ted, right, when I talked to lots of superintendents, principals, families, you know, of the folks who graduate from high school, less than half of our graduating seniors are going to any college. Of course, I'd love them all to go to Pima, but a lot of, you know, less than half are going anywhere. So I don't worry about, right, about the students who are going off to these great universities, University of Arizona and beyond. And we have some students coming to Pima, but I think about, wow, 53% of the graduating seniors in Pima County aren't going to any post-secondary training or education. So how do I reach those folks?
That's something to think about a lot. That is truly an important statement. Because it's those folks who are not going, they might be able to find jobs.
Sure.
Historically, they're not what you would call maybe living wage. And even if they're living wage, they're not family wages. They're not something you can start creating wealth. You can look for it. It is factually true that every level of training or education you get beyond high school significantly increases your lifetime earnings.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. I hear these conversations around a college education. Yes, we all have the aunt or uncle who didn't go to college and is a multimillionaire. Yes, those things happen. But on average, right, just to your point, if you earn an associate's degree, again, this is the average, your lifetime earnings, you know, $500,000, right? $500,000. You get the bachelor's degree. Again, on average, many people do beyond this, it's $1 million over a lifetime. That's meaningful differences for folks. By the way, there's even health outcomes tied to educational attainment rates, right? You live longer, you're healthier. So yes, not everyone needs a college education. And by the way, at Pima, you know, sometimes people think about a college education. Again, we're talking in, this could be a certificate program, right? You know, it could be in welding, or, you know, I often think if I was a young man coming out of the service as I was and was looking into college, I kind of went a traditional university route. Wow, I would be looking at some of these robotics, advanced manufacturing, automotive. I mean, these are great, great jobs. They're hands-on. They look like a lot of fun to me as I walk through the labs and see our students thriving in those spaces. So, yeah, it's not just, you know, sometimes I see the students and I see their eyes, a college education, and they're like, oh, you know, they're picturing themselves sitting in a class. But it's so many different things.
And to your point, the trades are a great place where we're having shortages. A lot of the trade technicians, the lifetime welding, you mentioned welding, but HVAC, electronics, there's so many
building
places.
Construction technology, all of those spaces,
All the spaces that PCC is expanding and making these certifications possible, a college degree or a certification is no longer daunting.
Right.
There's organizations and locations, and I think we're lucky in this region, is one community college covers the entire region.
Right.
We've got five campuses spread out, and it's truly kind of amazing in the direction.
Yeah, with centers of excellence on each of those spaces. And again, even how you get education, our online, Pima Online, continues to grow in leaps and bounds. Lots of hybrid classes where you can go in and talk to people in real life and get that hands-on, high-quality experience, but then get some of that content online. So it's all about flexibility for the students and giving them lots of options.
And you're still doing all this with little to no state funding. You've talked one-off. Right. I think the certificate programs, I mean, you just look at aircraft mechanic programs, and there's a lot of programs that I think get our legislature's attention. But right now, as I recall, Pima and Maricopa still are the two community colleges.
We don't get any maintenance or operations funds from the state. It's been over a decade, which is, right, again, this is about investing in our workforce. So we'd love to see some of that funding restored. We do get some. We receive some money for our Promise program, some STEM funding. We do get some from the legislature, and we're grateful for that. But we'd like to see some sustained state funding, of course.
Well, there's no doubt what the community college, what the role you play. And it's proofs in the pudding, so to speak. Your number of students you have is continuing to rise. You've got programs set up, and it's exciting.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the quality of the programs and the people at Pima, right, that we continue to attract students. Like I said, every semester we've grown and grown pretty significantly this fall, and we'll keep that outreach going. And that's, I think, critical for our community.
Well, before we go to the break, let's take a question. We've got a caller. David's called in on line two. David, welcome to the Morning Voice.
Good morning, Ted. Good morning, Chancellor.
Good morning.
Question for the Chancellor. He did mention the artificial intelligence and maybe looking at curriculum around that. I think that's extremely important. I see a need for that rapidly increasing. Are there any other community colleges in the United States that are currently leading? And what would it take to implement a program like that as soon as possible?
Sure. Yeah, great. Yes, I think educational organizations, including community colleges, have all jumped in around artificial intelligence. And I have to give our faculty and staff credit, right? They have really jumped in feet first. And where we're seeing it, David, is across the curriculum. So in health sciences, for example, you know, our respiratory therapy, our nursing programs, they're all embracing artificial intelligence. I even sat recently in an English class, a writing class, kind of that traditional composition class, and they're using AI in that class in just remarkable ways. It was interesting to see how the instructor was deploying that, and students were engaging in all kinds of different research and tools. And so it's not just one thing. Certainly in our computer science, you know, we have I mentioned our cybersecurity program, and we're really thinking about how are we layering on, you know, more advanced artificial intelligence applications in those programs. But even in the traditional you know, Ted mentioned the trades. Technology, virtual reality, AI, all of those are becoming more and more part of those businesses as well. And so we want to make sure that I don't care what you're studying at Pima, that you have that tool, you're able, because that's what people expect in the workplace, that you can successfully deploy artificial intelligence in a lot of different ways. So yeah, there's certainly lots of community colleges that have programs and have jumped into this space across the country, and we're trying to do likewise.
Thank you for calling, David. We appreciate you listening to The Morning Voice. And with that answer, that was the voice of Dr. Jeff Nassy. And we will go to the break. Stay with us. We've still got one more segment with the Chancellor. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. And we're going to continue our conversation with Chancellor Jeff Nassy right now. So appreciate you taking the time, as always, to join us.
Of course. Great to be here.
Pima Community College is flourishing. Would you say that?
Absolutely.
And it's such a huge driver of the economy in our area. I understand you may have just completed an economic impact study.
Yeah, all of the Arizona Community College went forward last year and went out with for a economic impact study, and then they did one for each individual college. And I don't want to steal too much thunder. I've sent the report to our board, but yeah, you know, well over $1 billion in local economic impact is the result of the study from Pima Community College. When you think about as an employer, right, a large employer, you know, we're serving 35,000 students. We have 5 campuses. Certainly an economic impact there. But more importantly, right, people going out into the community and what they're contributing to the workforce is a huge driver. You know, what they call the alumni, right, the people who finish again, you know, like I said, $1 billion in that economic impact. And it can't be overstated, the impact that the colleges has on our local community.
Well, there's no doubt about that. And this program's about getting people engaged and getting people to take part in their community. And you've more than done that. I mean, from the moment you came here, you jumped in with both feet. You're a member of SALC. You're on the board there. You're also on the board at the Chamber of Southern Arizona. You've not just filled the seat, but you are actively engaged in that. And
I appreciate you saying that, Ted.
How do you encourage your entire campus to get involved in helping economic development and community progress?
Yeah, so I think in a couple different ways. I mean, it's a mutual encouragement. You know, it's in our name, right? Community College. And I take great pride in that, right? We are the community's college. And so we have to be responsive. And right, we have a diverse community. It's everything, right? It's families, it's students, it's business, it's industries. It's our educational partners, right? University of Arizona, hospital districts, all of that is our community. One of the things we talk about in that space is market-driven curriculum. So that's what we teach. What are we providing to students? And so we have to have that engagement. We have wonderful and large scales. And I can tell you, I work with community college professionals from across the state of Arizona, nationally. We are really proud of the partnerships that we have with small businesses, large businesses across our ecosystem. And it's not about just, okay, we have a relationship. It's, hey, what should we be teaching? What are you looking for in your students? What's the latest happening with, you know, Raytheon, where we have apprenticeships, Caterpillar, you know, Tucson Medical Center, all of these things that help shape what we do. So then we can go out and make sure that, you know, we have that kind of, that circle, that ecosystem of great quality workforce. And again, going back to that first goal, we just need more of it, right? Again, that 53% coming out of high schools. By the way, it's not just about high schools, right? Lots of working adults. How do you upskill in AI?
We had
a really successful program. We partnered with the Arizona Technology Council and the great work that they do in providing professional credit, right? So not non-college credit courses. How do you apply AI? I don't care if you own a local pool business. How are you using that to advance what you do as a small business owner? And those offerings fill up. We have the Southern Arizona Technology and Entrepreneurship Centers, SATEC, and encouraging entrepreneurship. And you know what's great, Ted, is SATEC is located in our Applied Technology Center there at our downtown campus. So you can go down and prototype stuff out of our manufacturing lab and 3D printing. And so providing support for local businesses, you know, it's a lot of times, yeah, we want to increase that pipeline from high schools, but wow, there's lots of working adults that we can really upskill in a lot of areas that we loved. And so really focusing, you know, part of that first goal is what we call a no wrong door, right? Any way you can get into the college at any time. And by the way, see it at graduation, right? Yes, we have 16 and 17 year olds, but we also got 60 and 70 year olds
absolutely
earning credentials as well, and for meaningful reasons, right? Towards meaningful employment. So it's exciting.
Well, I love the fact that you're that engaged with the community. There's so many organizations and entities, I mean, Raytheon and others, that have a whole bunch of needs. Everybody goes, oh, it's just engineers. No, there's a lot of needs in these corporate companies and organizations, and I appreciate that you are leading the community college in that direction. So thank you, Dr. Nassy, for joining us today, and I look forward to having you again.
All right. Well, we'll do it. Take care.
Thank you. Stay with us. We'll be back with Josh Jacobson at the top of the hour.
You can follow along on YouTube. 1030 The Voice is the channel. Hit that subscribe button. Go to Facebook. You can also hit the like button on Facebook. 1030 The Voice is our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Good morning and welcome back. Appreciate you joining us. I've got Matt Neely behind the glass. Matt, you ready to get a little bit more involved in this conversation?
I am. Yes.
All right. We just had a
part of the festivities yesterday.
Great first hour with Dr. Jeff Nassy, Pima Community College Chancellor. A lot going on. And therefore, we figured we should follow up him up with a former Pima Community College student himself. and that's the chuckle of Josh Jacobson, who's pretty known to many of you listeners. But if not, we'll get a quick introduction with him. So, Josh, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ted.
All right. So Josh is extremely engaged in the community through both the chamber, the Southern Arizona Leadership Council, and most known for at this time is probably his role with the Tucson Crime Free Coalition. But we'll talk about that here in a couple minutes. Why don't you let the listeners who may not be aware, may not have heard your voice before, know what's your background?
Sure.
What is it you do in this community?
Yeah, well, it's been a little while, so thanks so much for having me back on, Ted.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever been on the Morning Voice version. I think you were. I know I had you in on Jump In, but
yes, yeah, that's
right. It's good to have you back.
Yeah, so for some reason you look different.
I thought things were getting boring.
So, like you said, my name's Josh Jacobson. For the listeners, I'm a local restaurant operator. A few years ago, actually 3 years ago, yesterday. Was our three-year anniversary of the formation of the Tucson Crime Free Coalition, which was, you know, pretty fitting since we had an event last night. But what happened about 3.5 years ago, there were a couple of us in the community that were seeing issues that were very concerning. Kevin Daly, my partner, he lives in the Flowing Wells area. He started seeing a lot of people down in the tunnels, the drainage ditches, a lot of drug paraphernalia. Items were getting stolen from the neighborhood. That was concerning to him. Monica Carlson is another one of my partners. She has a business on Fort Lowell. I think right now probably Fort Lowell is probably one of the worst parts of Tucson in terms of crime and drug activity. People, you know, it's impossible not to recognize that. And so she has a business there that's greatly affected. And then we've got a fourth steering leader named Oliver Swan, and he has a property on Stone Avenue in the Sugar Hill neighborhood, and he's been having problems. So what happened was, is basically the four of us just all collided 3.5 years ago.
Now, did you all know each other before then?
We had never met each other at all, and total strangers, but as it is 3.5 years later, we're, you know, family. It's been a really interesting ride, and we all have just one mission, and that's to create a safer and more prosperous Tucson for everyone. And so over the last 3 years, after we formed the Tucson Crime Free Coalition, we've worked on solutions that we have been able to grow here locally, just because our perspective of the substance use disorder crisis and the associated symptoms, which are crime and chronic homelessness is that we have started off at the street level. We start off in the encampments. We go through the encampments. We go through the tunnels underground. We find out what is really going on with the homeless community. We work with navigators. Those are people that are on the streets. They're like the front line of the nonprofits that are going out and trying to, you know, get people whatever it is that they need and direct them to services. We work with law enforcement. We work with the government. We work with other advocacy groups like the Southern Arizona Leadership Council when we have ran legislation in the past. And Ted, you were obviously a huge part of that, and we're excited to do it again.
Yeah, we got to do it again. I think this will be the third year attempt.
It will be the third attempt. Yep,
and it's closer every time.
Closer every time. It's, you know, we'll get there, and then we also work with elected officials. Not all elected officials like us, but we don't have any feelings. We don't have any ego. We just want to work with anybody that wants to make Tucson a better place. And so our perspective on that is we've created the Transition Center in conjunction with, you know, that's a big Pima County project, but Justice Services runs that. That's a solution that we have seen actually be able to reduce recidivism rates by connecting people to services as they come out of the jail, or if TPD brings somebody there, or if somebody just wants to walk in and, you know, see if there's some sort of opportunity for them to get something that they need to get themselves back on their feet. That's the first phase of it. And that's been going for about a year and a half. Like I said, great results coming out of that. It needs to be expanded. It needs some more funding.
So let's go a little bit deeper on that. Let's talk a little bit. You mentioned you've got the Transition Center.
Right.
So what is it? Where is it at?
Okay.
And how do people get entered into it?
Yeah. To go deeper into that, up until a couple of years ago, like 18 months ago, if somebody was released from the Pima County Jail, they were just pushed out the Sally Port. Like, you know, here you go, back out onto the street. Well, what do you think would happen? People would go back to doing whatever got them to the Pima County Jail in the first place, right? So the Transition Center is actually a building that's staffed with navigators, people that have lived experience, people that have been incarcerated or have overcome addiction. They are in there. And so when somebody is released from jail, they walk through and they come through this building and the navigators just greet them, say, hey, you know, how are you doing today? You know, do you need anything? And oftentimes that leads to a conversation. That conversation leads to connecting people to services. The numbers show that people that take advantage of the Transition Center, the recidivism rates drop from 27% to 9% within the next 30 days. So they track, you know, the folks that are caught committing another crime once they're released in a 30-day period. So we're getting 27% down to a 9% recidivism rate for Anton.
So you're cutting the recidivism into a third. And the key, mm-hmm. anybody you talk to, whether it's people involved with the prisons, people involved yep. with law enforcement, the government. I mean, you used to hear it all the time out of government, out of Governor Ducey, was the goal should be zero recidivism.
Right.
The goal is to get people the help they need when they find themselves in trouble. And sometimes you have to get in trouble to really right. want that hand. And so the Transition Center is an attempt
right.
to do that. And so far, the numbers support that it's successful.
Oh, absolutely. And Ted, you actually hit the nail on the head right there. When you said that sometimes people have to find themselves in trouble to take that hand, that is the whole thing. You know, if you find yourself in the Transition Center, that's when people are coming out of jail. They're thinking to themselves, you know, maybe it's time to make a lifestyle change. Maybe I should do something different. And that is the perfect time to offer somebody treatment and services. So we need to expand it. The city of Tucson needs to put some money into it because they haven't done it yet.
Who's funding it right now?
Right now, it is all grant funded through Justice Services. And just in the first year alone, cutting that recidivism rate the way that we did from 27% to 9%, that actually, not only did it get people, you know, some of the help that they needed, got people back on their feet, but it also saved taxpayers nearly $1 million in just a year. So that's fantastic. And so now what we're looking at is we need the city of Tucson to come to the table because it's underutilized. Just like many, many of our treatment programs, our shelter spaces, they're underutilized. People don't necessarily realize that because the story we hear in the media all the time is, you know, we're overflowing. There's no capacity for anybody. And that's actually just not true. We even have plenty of room for more Section 8 vouchers. But at any rate, we need to get the city of Tucson to the table. They need to pony up some money. We need to get the transition center open 7 days a week because right now it's only open 5 days a week. We can have TPD utilized even more. But here's the bigger thing, Ted.
Tell me it's open on the weekends, though.
No. It's Monday through Friday. Business hours.
When are the majority of releases occurring?
You know, it's kind of scattered out throughout the week.
Okay.
But you're right, there are busier days. Friday is a busy day, you know. And so depending on when you get in, you are getting, there's plenty of people that are released on Saturday and Sunday. And that's why we need this thing going 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So that's phase one. We need that expansion of the hours, but phase one's already going. Phase two, and here's the bigger part of the solution. I can see that we're getting close to break here.
Matt and I play a little loose with our breaks.
Oh,
so
we
keep
do?
Going.
Okay. So the phase two, many people probably know that on the corner of Mission and Silver Lake, it's on the property of the Pima County Jail, is a 50,000 square foot building called the Annex. This building has been sitting empty for several years now. It is safe. It is secure. It could provide shelter space for up to 300 people. We could bring in nonprofits. We could bring in service providers. And so what we want to do, and again, all we need is players at the table, the decision makers in our community to make this happen, is what we would have is we would have the transition center as the point to triage people. And this could be, like I said, walk-ins, people that TPD brings by, people that are coming out of jail, assess what they need. If they need short-term treatment, shelter, detox, whatever it is, they could go over to the annex. They could be housed there for a short period of time to get them ready for a warm handoff to the next location that they would be going to, whether it's La Frontera, Gospel Rescue Mission, or Veteran Rescue Mission, whatever it is. And that's a real solution because it's not a dirt lot on the side of Grant Road, and I know we're going to talk about that. It's not another encampment, and we can talk about the encampments because we spend a lot of time there, and the encampments, I can tell you, are absolutely dire and horrific, and it's inhumane that we allow them to go on to the extent that we do in Tucson. And because it's secure and because we would be doing warm handoffs to folks, you wouldn't have the issues that spill out into the neighborhoods that we see at these other encampments and other sites.
It's also that warm hand.
That's right.
It's that helping hand that they need. And if they show a glimmer of willingness to take it, and we're not taking advantage of that and helping them potentially change the direction that their lives are going, we're missing a great opportunity.
That's right. We also have to be aware that there's a lot of people on the streets right now that are completely service resistant. They're not going to take an opportunity because a lot of opportunities have been presented, but they are so stuck. You know, people have to understand, you know, one of the biggest issues with addiction, when you're an addict, if you have life experience with addiction, which many people do in our community, whether it's them personally or family members, you have to understand that an addict that has been living in the addiction cycle for an extended period of time, it is terrifying to think about giving up your drug of choice. And it is more, there's more comfort in staying on the street and living that way, which is, again, I mean, you have to understand how badly the street drugs hijack people's minds today.
No, that's absolutely truth. So we're going to take a break now. When we come back, I want to talk about the bill that we've been trying to get through at the legislature,
yep,
and why that has an opportunity to break that cycle.
Sure.
If we can get it through.
Right.
And that's the goal. So that's the voice
Third
of Josh.
Third time's a charm.
That's the voice of Josh Jacobson with Sunland Foods, with Lucky Wishbone, and with the Tucson Crime Free Coalition.
Yep.
So we'll be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely is behind the glass, and Josh Jacobson with the Tucson Crime Free Coalition, amongst many different organizations, is with us in the studio. So, Josh, again, appreciate you being with us. We took off that first segment and just ran.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, so, and Ted, I actually, I just call myself an advocate for Tucson these days.
Well, that's true.
Know, that's like the short thing, you know, because I've been here, you know, basically my entire life. I don't want to be anywhere else. I want to see our community get back to the community that I knew when I was growing up. And I hear from a lot of people that have left, have come back. Like, they'll say, you know, there's parts of Tucson that are unrecognizable now.
So real quick, let's go down a little of those routes. Where'd you go to high school?
Oh, well, I was actually the first class through Catalina Foothills High School. My parents, being entrepreneurs, moved here, you know, like many entrepreneurs starting out, dead broke. But one thing that they always wanted to make sure is that my brother and I had the opportunity to get the best education. So we would rent little townhomes or apartments in the Foothills area. We moved like every year, which was it just became like the thing, because that's, you know, I don't know why we moved so much, but I'll tell you, I don't want to move like hardly ever again. But at any rate, yeah, you know, been here for forever, always been really involved with the community. Obviously, the community supports our businesses quite a bit, and so we're always happy to give back. And then, you know, stumbling into these roles and even working with projects with you on SALC and Southern Arizona Leadership Council and some of the legislation that we've ran. And we want to get that going again this coming session.
Well, there's no doubt you've put yourself out there. Some people have berated you about it. Some people have jumped on board and joined you. But the one thing you're not afraid to do is to speak up. So that's why... You're perfect on the radio. So
well, thank you.
We'll keep you coming back.
You know, if you're not getting criticized, are you really relevant?
That's true.
You know, like
it means you're being heard.
Yeah.
As well. Let's talk about the legislation.
Sure.
So the first time you ran the bill was 2 years ago.
Yeah. So one of the things that we've done with Tucson Crime Free Coalition is we've studied, you know, what has worked elsewhere, what has not worked elsewhere. There's a lot that we can learn. And so we started looking in depth at California and their CARES court that Governor Newsom got up and going. And so we started looking at that, like how can we incorporate that here? And basically what we found out is that there's a mechanism in the majority of the states across the country where there's a provision for hard drugs in their legislation or their ARS that is in regards to mental health. Arizona's is Title 36. In Title 36 here in Arizona, if somebody is determined that they are brought to somewhere like the crisis response center because they're displaying really erratic behavior. I mean, talk about, you know, somebody that's wandering around Grant and Oracle with no pants on, you know, muttering to themselves. Police officers will pick somebody like that up and take them to somewhere where they can get some sort of mental evaluation. Under our Title 36 provision, if they are just determined that they're high, they're on fentanyl, they're on meth, whatever it is, well, they have to be released within 24 hours. And that means that they can just walk back out. They can get hit by a car like we see happen in Tucson all too often. They can go back to, you know, maybe a washer, encampment, whatever it is. Bottom line, just like we were talking about in the last session or section of the show, is that we need to connect people to treatment options. And when somebody is completely high, it's really hard to have a rational conversation about how we can improve their conditions. So what we are proposing is to make Pima County a pilot program for the rest of the state of Arizona. And we would create a provision where, rather than being booted out of an evaluation center in less than 24 hours, if it is determined that it would be beneficial, they could stay there for up to 5 days. Now, I want to emphasize this is all done with due process. It is making sure that people's civil liberties stay intact. But the whole goal is to stabilize people, bring them down out of the high, and then have a conversation about, okay, how can we get you into services? What do you need? What are your conditions? So that we can you know, make it so that they're not going to get killed or commit crimes or do it. Break the substance use disorder cycle. It is all about disrupting that.
How'd you come up with 5 days?
Well, great question. So our iteration that we ran last session, we actually compiled, we learned from the first time we ran it. We did it ourselves, and it was our first try out of the gate. And it was a big learning experience, which, you know, hey, you got to have those experiences. But the second time, we compiled a pretty big team here in Pima County, legal staff, clinicians from the CRC that actually helped write the legislation. And they were the ones that determined 5 days is an appropriate period, up to 5 days, is an appropriate period to try to stabilize somebody to have a rational conversation. Then there was a second component that we were going after, which is, again, we're always talking about how do we improve people's living conditions and how do we save taxpayers money? So as it is now, we've got these folks that they're going back to the crisis response center over and over and over and over again, staying 24 hours at a time and not getting the help they need. Well, by opening it up to have them stay a little bit longer, we need funding from Access to pay for those extended days, but being able to get them into the services, we expect the drop in recidivism rates of folks going back to the crisis response center to save taxpayers money as well. So that was another part of it. And again, you know, the beauty of this program, we had Senator Vince Leach, who is our primary sponsor. And he was going to help with the financial aspect of it because there was a small amount of money. I mean, it was a drop in the hat to get this pilot program going. But we felt like it was a really good option. Pima County would have done it for 3 years. I believe we would have been reporting back to the rest of the state in 2028.
Yeah, it was kind of nice to watch it work its way through the process. Originally did not have bipartisan support. By the end, it had bipartisan support. Originally, it was going to be statewide. By the end, it was a trial time in Pima County, which is all you specifically were looking for. Help Pima County. That's what you're focused on, is let's improve this region. So,
yeah.
He got close. Vince Leach is coming back for one more term. I believe he's already told us he'll run that bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've learned a lot every year, and we've got a chance this coming year.
Yeah. It's exciting.
Got to think positive, Josh. Got to think positive. It's the legislature. It's an election year.
Yes,
but
it is.
It's the legislature. We'll just have to keep working it hard. So when we get back, we're going to talk with Josh about a press conference Tucson Crime Free held last night, and the topics that were discussed there and on the news, if you were watching. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass and Josh Jacobs is with me. Tomorrow, if you tune in, you'll have Grant Kruger waking you up with a food for thought. So that is always a interesting conversation. It could be about food, it could be about restaurants, and it could be about some politics. So
could be about whatever Grant just happens to think about as he's driving down here.
Detroit. You just never know.
I don't know where he comes up with this stuff, and then he just boom, goes.
So he's the thing I like about Grant is he's always so prepared, and his voice is the what I call the radio fired up voice.
Oh yeah.
You know, he's always got the passion going, and it's always got positive vibes. So,
and you know, he only has one vocal cord, right?
Huh?
Yeah. He has one vocal cord. You didn't know that, Matt?
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So, and I'm like, well, how did you lose the other one? He's like, oh, talking too much.
Okay. That makes sense now, I guess.
So that's why, you know, I mean, like that's why his speech is the way it is. But I mean, let's understand. Grant has about 15 cups of coffee in the morning before.
I've started bringing in decaf in the morning for this show. Because if I sit here drinking the coffee they make around here, whoo!
Yeah.
Yeah, you get fired up real quick. You go. I think that's something that the management's got in the coffee here that just keeps you rolling. So great opening half hour. Talked a lot about what Tucson Crime Free's coalition to do. And we talked about Vince Leach carrying it. But the fact of the matter is your organization is a nonpartisan organization.
We are nonpartisan,
I don't think anybody realized some of the party affiliations of the the leaders of that group. It's because you never talk about it.
Right.
And I was surprised to see that they're all represented. You've got you've got the party, the independents, everybody's represented both in the leadership of Tucson Crime Free and amongst your membership. Now, I know we always, I give you a hard time all the time about the membership, but when you count membership, how many people are receiving your newsletters now?
So we've got 8,500 people that receive our newsletters, which has been part of the secret to our success in the past when we have done calls to action at the city council or the board of supervisors, or having people respond to our bill in the legislature even, or other bills that we have helped out in the legislature. Like we've worked with Consuelo and Alma Hernandez in the legislature. We've worked with Teamsters Local 104 here to help run legislation for them and sign in and support. So we do things all across the board. Now, where we have the reputation of being a political organization is because sometimes we are critical of our local elected leaders that are making decisions that we think are not in the best interest of the community. So apparently when you disagree with political leadership, all of a sudden, well, that's because you have a different ideology. And well, that's not true.
And it's very hard. I'll give you some backup on this one, because it's very hard because you don't go out advertising the makeup of your membership or the party affiliation of your membership. And again, I know for a fact that the leadership of your organization has all the different parties represented. It's not a factor to you, because all you care about is trying to make this a better place.
That's right.
We talked a lot about the homeless situation, and I don't want to call it the homeless situation, because sometimes the homeless that we see are predominantly those folks in a large part that are hindered by drug and alcohol and serious mental illness.
Right.
I mean, that is really what we're talking about. There's a lot of homeless that might be couch surfing, that might be sleeping in cars, that are doing other things that many of us in the community don't even see. But what you're trying to do is to take that element that we do see that leads to crime. You're a small business owner.
Right.
What kind of impact has the homeless situation had on you and some of your shops?
Yeah, so you put it in a great way there, Ted. I mean, a great way for a pretty terrible situation. When we are talking about homelessness, we're talking about the chronically homeless individuals on the streets. And that is a symptom of serious mental illness and substance use disorder, which we know those two go hand in hand. And that's why it's so important that we update Title 36, because there are provisions in Title 36, like we talked about earlier, for serious mental illness, but not substance use disorder. And that's a problem, because that's what the statistics show. So, our businesses, what we have had to do, what I personally have had to do, is you have to keep investing money into security measures. You have to basically buy new equipment to, frankly, make yourself a more difficult target to be taken advantage of. You know, that's like the most bottom line way to put it. So, for instance, on some of our properties, we have like an entryway that is kind of an alcove. And what would happen is people would come and they would build warming fires against our building. That's really dangerous. So in order to curb that, I had to invest in giant wrought iron gates that have hinges. We lock them open during the day. At night, we close them. That was a $10,000 per location expenditure just on that alone. That's just one example. The other part that's really frustrating is, you know, being a small business owner, your staff, you know, your team members, those people become like family. And so when I find out or I see somebody come in that is in, you know, they might be in a psychotic episode, and that's really unfortunate. But when they take it out on my staff or my customers, that's when I, as the business owner, start taking it very personally. And, you know, you go into the mode of protecting your family. And we have that happen too often. We actually have a location that's across the street from the Pima County Jail. And we've had people that have gotten out of jail, come right over to our place, caused issues, and then they go right back to jail. And it was just because they weren't ready to come out yet, or they hadn't. And back then, the transition center wasn't open yet, so they didn't have the opportunity to get connected to services, so they were just still upset.
Yeah, so in the first part of the half hour, I was writing down things, as you were saying, opportunities, education, employment, treatment, and support.
Right.
That's the kind of services that we need if we're truly going to make an impact and make a help. Yesterday, Tucson Crime Free held a press conference.
Correct.
And it was on something that's gotten a lot of attention lately, but only for the last couple of weeks, because it only became known several weeks ago.
Yeah, in the beginning of August.
And that is a place called Star Village. So can you talk first a little bit about what Star Village is?
Yes.
And then talk about your organization's position on it, what came out of the press conference yesterday.
Sure. So Star Village is, it's a dirt lot on Grant and Stone area. It's going to be turned into...
It's owned by the city of Tucson, correct?
It's owned by the city of Tucson. It's in the Sugar Hill neighborhood, which is a historically black community. And I say that because there's a lot of pride in that neighborhood association. There's a lot of history there. It's going to be a sanctioned low barrier encampment that the city is going to run in conjunction with a couple of nonprofits. It's a very small site. We're talking about 25 tents. It's not going to be inside. It's a chain link fence with a privacy screen around it. And it's 25 tents for women and non-binary individuals. Now, we also want to mention that is an area that has already been under a lot of stress. It is right down the street from Grant and Oracle. I don't know how many times I have heard Mr. Neely talk about headlines that stem from that part of town. There is already a lot of crime, already a lot of drug addiction. There's, you know, a lot of police activity that has been put into that area to curb that. But then as soon as the police activity goes away, everything fills right back up.
It's so, also near Heidrick, pronounce it wrong, Heidrick Acres and the Navajo the Navajo Wash encampment, which has been a huge problem for years for those neighbors.
Yes. And we actually had Adrian Wuhr, who was one of the plaintiffs in the Navajo Wash lawsuit, with us last night. So, you know, our position on encampments, and I could do a whole segment about what we see when we go into the encampments, and they're dire. The encampments are dire. The city is going to say, they're saying that they're going to keep this safe. They're going to keep it secure. And I'm sure that they want to believe that's the case. And they will have some sort of presence inside of the four walls of the encampment. But what happens is the crime activity spills over to the surrounding community, the businesses, the residents. So a lot of the residents are very concerned about the drug activity that's already in the area, the prostitution, the assaults, the break-ins, the vandalism to the businesses. That's already happening. And then when you take an encampment and you create it, what you are also doing is you're creating a captive drug market. And it's important to know that this is a low barrier encampment. The city's saying that people won't be able to use drugs inside of the chain link fence. They're going to be using the drugs on the outside if they can actually control.
And so it doesn't actually prevent somebody from having drugs in there. They just can't use them.
Well, they have rules. They have these loose rules, but who's going to enforce them? How are we going to know? You know, and so let's say that they do enforce them. Let's say that they do make it so that you can't use drugs or possess drugs inside there. You don't have to have any sort of level of sobriety. You don't exactly have to take any advantage of support or treatment options they're offering. So of course, the activity is going to spill over into the surrounding area. And we've seen this happen time and time again. Estevan Park, the city gave the Splinter Collective, which is a nonprofit, you know, $70,000 to run that encampment. It was dire. It was horrible in there. It was a failed experiment. And what it does, you know, Ted, imagine that you're a property owner in the area and you've worked your whole life and you're, you know, maybe you're retired or you've got your house paid off or you finally bought a little shop in the area. Well, encampments destroy the property value, because right. if you're someone that's going to buy a house, are you going to buy a house that's in close proximity to an encampment? Hell no. You know, same thing right. with businesses. It's so it's really unfortunate to the folks in the area.
Well, I know with it being 20, I've heard some folks say it's 25 people. Is that enough now? I know the city's response, because having conversations with them, well, that's mm-hmm. 25 lives you can change. And the key is, how have the encampments so far been on changing lives? That's I guess, my question. Yep. I think, yes, the giving people who don't have the drug addictions or the mental health, giving them some living facilities, there's a lot of ways to do it. But encampments,
right.
it tends not to be.
Encampments are not the answer. You know, even just going back to phase two of the transition center, I know we're jumping into break here, but we've got a building that could house 300 people. Why are we playing around with 25?
Right.
If we're going to make a difference, let's do it.
So who all was there last night?
So we had several people from the Sugar Hill neighborhood. Jack Anderson, who's the president of the neighborhood.
He was on the news last night yep. talking about it.
Fantastic guy, long history in the area. And then we had four other people, one business owner, Oliver Swan, who is on Tucson Crime Free, and then three other residents, including Adrian Wuhr, who has lived. He has lived with an encampment in his front yard, and that's what triggered him to file the Navajo Wash lawsuit, which he won. And during that lawsuit, we found out how the city is enabling people to stay on the streets and working against getting people into shelter and services.
Well, let's save that for after the break. It's a nice tease, a nice hook. We'll hear what Josh Jacobson says the city's doing to help people stay on the streets. I think I've got my own personal opinion on allowing people to live like that, even if they choose to. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that when we get back. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell. Appreciate you joining us today. Matt Neely's been, as usual, spot on with both the tunes and with our timing. Appreciate it, Matt, for all you do back there. And we're with Josh Jacobson. Had an incredible conversation about one of his ventures into an encampment. It's something I think a lot of people just don't really understand.
Right.
That the hierarchy and the structure in those encampments. They're like, you know, I heard somebody the other day talk about it. It's kind of like Lord of the Flies. You're going to get something that's going to... Human beings thrive in structure.
Right.
And there's always those that want to be in charge and those that don't mind having somebody else in charge. Mm-hmm. It almost becomes parochial.
Right. Well,
to some extent,
you know, back to knowing that the encampments, I mean, they're drug camps. If you're suffering from homelessness, it's chronic homelessness. And the reason you're in an encampment is because you have a drug addiction and serious mental illness. That's the bottom line.
And don't think for a minute that there's not drug dealers in all those encampments. Don't think for a
That's
minute
exactly
that
right.
there's not somebody profiting.
That's right.
Either through the crime or the funding or the money. I mean, I remember a story, I think when they were cleaning the encampment down by the train station or the train line, the UP line, that you helped.
Estevan.
Down in Estevan, there a police officer looked at somebody going, "Do you need a place to stay?" And the guy looked at him and said, "Sir, I'm not homeless, but I have a drug problem.
Right.
That's why I'm here."
Yeah.
So they go to the encampments because they know, I mean, even folks who are not homeless can go to the encampments and find drugs.
Right.
It's an access point.
And oftentimes the people that have the power in the encampments, they're not the ones that live there. They're the drug dealers. And so that's when we talk about who's really in charge of these encampments. The city can say they're going to be at Star Village. They can say that they're going to have outreach there. But again...
And the question I have, and I will reach out and ask this question of the city, is how much are you going to spend to ensure there's enough security to take care of that 25? Whereas, to your point, if we can get a facility that's got 300 mm-hmm. for about the same amount of security, you may be able to structure that, you know, low barrier, high barrier. You know, we've got a lot of facilities and we've got a lot of facilities that are very successful at helping people.
A lot of resources available.
A lot of resources available.
That are underutilized.
Yes, absolutely. So let's get back to the Star Village.
Yep.
press conference yesterday. I did see one video. There was people shouting and you know, holding signs and doing all that. So you talked about the folks that spoke. What was the turnout, and what's what's the general consensus from those communities that are around Star Village?
Yeah, so we actually had 120 people attend, and most of them were neighborhood people that were concerned and wanted to show their support. And we also had a lot of people that live in the surrounding community, because they know that this is a pilot program. The city has said it's a pilot program, which means that if the city, I'm doing the air quotes for the listeners here, if the city determines this is a success, well, they might be doing this on other city-owned property in your neighborhood. And, you know, people are looking for solutions. We all want to be compassionate.
How about Hakame Plaza? Just throwing that out there. How about that?
Well, you know what? There used to be folks that lived in the plaza. That used to happen. My son and I were down there going to City Hall, and we watched this giant altercation take place. Yeah. And so that's all cleaned out. You know, it's everybody thinks that sanctioned encampments are great until it's in their front yard. They're dealing with it, when they can't get to their front door, when they're cleaning up human feces and drug needles and drug paraphernalia every day, when they're confronted with the reality of what it is like. And that's why we need better solutions than a dirt lot on the side of Grant.
Out of sight, out of mind is such an easy solution for people to get to. It's move people. We've got to address the core issues.
Right.
And you've talked about that a lot. Until you're willing to address us, the legislative effort, the underlying issues for those who are criminal and on the street, and not everybody on the street's criminal, not saying that at all, but if you have a drug addiction, you have to find some way to get money.
That's right. And you know, that's the other part that we haven't touched on yet, Ted, but there is a situation where we do have to enforce our laws and ordinances. And just because somebody is in the throes of the substance use disorder cycle, that doesn't make them immune to following laws and being held accountable when they need to be. You know, if I've talked to so
many. Compassionate accountability is possible.
That's right.
Getting people help. We've talked about it before too. Are we really being compassionate human beings to let people live like this? Don't tell me it's a choice.
It's indifference disguised as compassion, and that's dangerous for a community.
Very much so. So that's the voice of Josh Jacobson. Josh, appreciate all you do in the community. Some like it, some don't. But the fact of the matter is you and your organization's trying to make a difference.
That's right. Thanks, Ted.
Appreciate it. We'll have you back. Matt, thank you for all the work. Please stay on 1030 The Voice and listen to Kathleen Wynn, Wynn Tucson, following this. And then tune in tomorrow for Grant Krueger, and next week and every day of the week for The Morning Voice.